Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview was a fascinating one. It was with a composer, which I think I've interviewed a couple of musicians over the years, certainly comedians and philosophers and social change advocates and so on, but not a composer, I don't think. Rolf Kent, who is an established and accomplished and I believe even celebrated composer for the work he's done on Alexander Payne's new film, Downsizing. You're going to find out why it is Alexander Payne said to Rolf, just sound like yourself. He's got a real passion for music. We talk about composing melody and how we avoid rigid course work and about creating chemistry and about how perspective is elusive and about how composing well for characters is really about following a path. It's a journey. It includes experimentation and shapes and poetry and ideas existing in his head and how he gets those through a translation process and gets them onto paper and, more importantly, I guess, into instruments and into other people's heads. He talks how he writes a lot while he walks and about what it means to be in motion. We talk about something called unexpected texture as well. I think you're going to really enjoy this. This is about Alexander Payne's new film, Downsizing, starring Matt Damon and many others. It's coming out really soon. In fact, probably already is out. Check it out. You might see it at the Oscars. You might hear about it at the Oscars this year. And don't forget, davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and writing. And patreon.com. Please go there and check it out. If you like what I'm doing here, you can support what we're doing on a monthly or an annual basis. And I certainly would appreciate that, as would all of my listeners. And of course, rabble.ca for more information about other podcasting and other news and current events that matter. Check that out, rabble.ca. Coming right up, Rolf Kent, about his work on the film, the new Alexander Payne film, Downsizing. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today. I've been really looking forward to this interview for quite some time. We've got a composer, a musician. Rolf Kent is joining us here today to talk about a whole lot of things, but about a film that he's been working on or has worked on, Downsizing. Rolf, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
I think, you know, Rolf, I was going to say, I feel like I've known you for years. I mean, my father apparently grew up, did you say 9 minutes away from where you live? 9 miles?
I'm about 9 miles, yeah.
9 miles. Isn't that, we share a UK passport. This is wonderful news. Me sitting up here just west of Toronto, you sitting in LA, and we both have a UK heritage. Yes, thanks again for taking the time today. So I'm going to read a quote off your site, if that's okay. Kent's great gift, quote, is his timbral control. He mixes sound, colors beautifully, even allowing in moments of spoken voice that are so fleeting and subdued that they become another musical instrument, close quote. That is a beautiful quote. You're sitting there, the quote is next to you with a guitar and headphones and a slew of instruments in the background. Can you tell me a little bit about
mixing sound colors beautifully. What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Nice. But great start.
Yeah, well, music is very intuitive. Mixing is I think mixing is pretty intuitive. It's quite technical. I mean, all art forms are part technique, partly technical, partly artistic. I don't know what that really necessarily means. The intuitive thing is, there's a reason that certain traditional arrangement shapes exist, because bass, drums, and guitar and voice, those things surround each other in a certain way. And if you're going to do something with sounds which are unusual, then you've simply got to find out what goes well with what, and how you're going to accomplish, a surround of a similar or more interesting or more diverting quality. So it's intuitive, but it's also, I suppose there's an element of logic to it. The idea that, you don't normally have two bass guitars in a band, and therefore, right, if you're going to have, a lovely bowed Indian instrument, then you look for something that to contrast against it or something. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to talk about it, other than it's very much intuition.
Well, is it fair? And I want to talk a little bit. I read your bio with fascination, based on your past, your theological past, and your non-formal training, and so on, and the fact that you come from a non-musical family. I'd love to hear more about that and how that plays out. But there's a sense, I suppose, in which music is kind of mathematical, right? But yet, so not. Like there's a way, I suppose, to represent it with numbers and graphs on the screen, but the decisions that really matter are things that you probably can't articulate that well, in a really explicit way.
I've always been a little, because it's a common argument that there is a strong mathematics to music, and it may be that mathematicians are often decent musicians and vice versa. I'm not sure. I don't really connect with that. I always like the idea, but when I really think about it, I mean, you have to be able to count, and
right. Yes, we can assume that. Yeah,
and there is a lot of when you're trying to figure out, especially when you're trying to sort of match rhythms to images, so that you've got a certain number of beats, or how much are you going to get in before this cut or this event? And so there is definitely a mathematics to it, but I think it's one of those things. I recently realized I got myself a tablet that I can use longhand on, because I realized whenever it comes to writing, there's a translation process. If I have a poetic idea in my head and I type it, if I have three lines of a verbal idea, I might remember two by the time I finish typing them.
Right.
But I might remember all of them by the time I finish longhand writing them. So there's definitely a translation process going on, isn't there? And in music, the same definitely applies, that you have this musical idea, but by the time you actually sort of figure out what the chords were on the piano or guitar or anything, and then if you had to also figure out what the rhythm was, and whether it was swung or not swung, and all of that stuff, I'm not Mozart. Mozart might have just thought that way.
Right.
For me, there's still a translation process. So, and there's definitely a mathematics to that. Ideally, you get it so fluid and so fluent that you don't get stuck in the translation. But, I think it's very hard not to lose something in the translation every time. I mean, whenever I go for walks, I love writing by walking. Both story ideas, but and also melodic ideas, and because there's something about walking, being in motion, that supports the idea. When you're simply staring at a blank page, the new idea feels very naked. Whereas when you're walking, or there's a couple of other things that also help, but that makes it feel somehow like it isn't quite so naked, and therefore you can have confidence in an idea. Then you bring it back, and I might have hummed it onto my phone or something, and then you try and find out how that translates onto a keyboard, and so there's that translation process then. But there's always, for me anyway, there's almost always a translation process where you.
I love the fact that you find it more I don't know, creative, I suppose, or dynamic going for a walk. It's the, there's the, rather than, like you said, staring at a blank page, there's that sense of relationship and oh, I don't know, there's something that flows about that in a way that you know sitting in front of a computer screen, I suppose, just doesn't.
Well, it's also yeah, exactly, and the it's why singing in the shower works best,
right? Because that's good.
It's the combination of the reverb that the shower gives you straight away, and the fact that all the noise, so it surrounds your idea, so that you've got to go, but in the shower that sounds full and rich and supported, and then you come out of the shower and try and write that down, and you go, really, is that all it was? And it suddenly feels right. Very naked again. Yeah,
that's cool. Tell me about your early school teacher who told you apparently not to. I love the line, to avoid rigid coursework. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that actually, I would imagine, opened you up into this, this beautiful, incredibly rewarding world that you've, made 50 films you've composed for. Is that right?
At least, yeah. The
remarkable.
Thank you. The teacher, yeah, he was, and still is, a really nice teacher. I mean, a really nice guy. And he noticed that I cared about music. I was always playing music in the practice rooms, and he taught me music O level, which in Britain at the time, that's what we did. It was O for ordinary, and
funny.
No, well, it's literally because we had O levels and A levels.
Okay.
They still have A levels for advanced, but the O levels have been replaced with GCSEs, and I'm not sure what that stands for. But anyway, so my music education finished at about when I was 14, when I took the music O level and passed with a C grade. But he observed in me my passion for music, and told my parents that he didn't think I should take the A level, because he said that it would kill my enthusiasm. Hmm. And for someone to sabotage their own department by losing
right.
Another student for the greater good, for good reasons, I thought it was very, very impressive. And it was also the way in which it was phrased. It in no way discouraged me from my interest in music. I mean, he could have said he's no good at music, and that would have been, I don't know whether that would have really, really bothered me, but it would have not been helpful. But to say his enthusiasm does not need to be, the rigid structure that would kill his enthusiasm. I think that was really a sweet and very constructive thing to do.
Sounds like a pretty wise teacher, and could speak moments of hopefully he spoke those kind of moments of profound wisdom into other students as well. But I think it's a remarkable thing to not only notice but to affirm and encourage as well. How did you know at such a young age? Like, I'm fascinated by this. I mean, so maybe not leaning towards the mathematical and the music thing. Does that also mean that you're not a determinist in the sense that, oh gee, I was given this genetic musical gift? Or would you kind of fall in that kind of category? That space.
Well, I don't know. By the way, I went back to see that teacher a few years ago.
Oh yeah,
and just to thank him.
Oh, good for you, man! That's so cool.
Thank him and I played him some of my scores, and he went, "Oh, man."
I did. He did. He didn't say "I told you so," did he?
No. But he said melody, because it's so no one writes melody anymore, apparently. And I vigorously compose melody. I don't think I was determinist. I mean, at the age of 14, I had numerous ambitions. I liked the idea of becoming a farm vet, really, just because I'd read the James Herriot books, and I,
of course,
that seemed such a beautiful romantic life. I'm so glad I'm not a vet on a farm. But I did entertain that idea for a while.
I think in order to become a vet, you need an education and a very large pair of rubber gloves. I believe that's all you need, isn't it?
Well, and an ability to be cheerfully ripped out into the cold every morning to deal with a lambing disaster or
that's right.
Yeah, it's actually, in retrospect, sounds quite grim. But anyway, there were various ambitions I had. But so no, I wasn't sure that I was hell bent on being a film composer. But I was inspired. From the age of 12, I thought film composing sounded like a very good direction. And one of the reasons I pursued bands and played in bands later on was, I always had that in the background. And I know this because, one of my band colleagues, one of my best friends, would quote me saying, "Well, you're the one who wants to become a film composer." And so it was clearly always there. And I had the extraordinary good fortune. So in terms of answering your question, it was I don't think it was sort of written in the genes, and I certainly didn't feel it wasn't a question of having to live up to something. It was always just, I've always been enthusiasm driven. I always think that enthusiasm is the best thing for everything. I mean, if you can have great teachers in every field that fire your imagination and enthusiasm, then you'd have incredible people who, would be inspired by physics and mathematics and music and French and everything. And I wish that for everybody. But my enthusiasm has always relentlessly pulled me towards music. Even when I thought I really wasn't that musical, I still, discover that no, that is still where the enthusiasm pulls me.
Beautiful. I love that phrase. What a beautiful title for something. Relentless enthusiasm. It's gorgeous. So clearly, I'm marveling at how many films you've worked a lot. Let's talk, maybe shift gears a tiny bit, but intimately connected, obviously, and talk a little bit about the film and just composing for film in general, because I find it really fascinating from a creative process. Where do you start? I was thinking about this as I was preparing and reflecting on our conversation today. And we talk about establishing shots in film. Do we talk about establishing sounds?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, I bet. And so, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So you've composed recently for Downsizing, but also you've worked quite intimately with Alexander Payne for quite a few years. And so, but anyway, tell me more about just, no pun intended, but setting that tone in a story.
The first film I did for Alexander Payne was really perhaps it wasn't quite the first film I ever scored, but it was nearly. And it was, he simply said, I don't want you to sound like anybody else. I just want you to sound like yourself. And it completely floored me because up to that point, no one had ever asked me to do anything but sound like, something. And
interesting.
And I'd done a lot of tons of short films, and this one's noir. Can you make it sounding jazzy and noir? And I go, sure, I can do that. And I do some research and make that. And this one needs a bossa nova. Can you write a bossa nova? And I go, sure, I can find out what that is and write that. And so, and here he is going, find your own way, be yourself. And I go, God, I don't know what I am. I have no idea.
Right.
So finding the tone for that first one, which was Citizen Ruth, that was mystifying and quite a challenge. And I wasn't, even though I found a tone which I was very happy with, I didn't initially recognize it as being me. I just thought it was the first thing I stumbled upon that kind of worked. And worked very, made me happy. It made everybody very content with the project. But I didn't recognize that as in any way a tonal signature for myself. And I think partly, in as much as I have a tonal signature, it's partly because of that film and the films that followed. Hollywood wants to know you for one thing. They don't want you to, they want who do we call when we have this kind of film? So that you tend to get somewhat typecast. So, I didn't enter the arena thinking I was going to do satires and comedies. I thought I was going to do thrillers. And yet, when you look at the 50 films, a somewhat disproportionate number of those will be satires and comedies. But so the searching for a tone is, but it's the same on any kind of film, whether it's a drama or a comedy. It's trying to figure out what the film wants to be. There's also the fact that, and I'm sure people don't really realize this, is that the tone is substantially missing when before the music turns up. So, you know, everyone knows what a film feels like once they've seen it, but what it would have been like if it had been scored differently is a right. completely different question. In fact, apparently, I never got to see it. I'm sorry I missed it, but Soderbergh recently posted posted a version of Raiders of the Lost Ark using the score, replacing the score with the score to The Social Network.
So is that that's John Williams to Trent Reznor, isn't it?
That is John Williams to Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And the his point, and it was also rendered into black and white. And his point was to show how great the editing was without all the showy music that highlighted it. And but, you know, I'm sure, as I say, I haven't seen that version, but I'm sure the tone is probably very different. And so the tone is largely or substantially invented by a composer. Now, it may be that the director knows what the tone should be,
right,
and implants that idea in the composer's mind, or not. Sometimes the director doesn't know. And
well, it sounds like Alexander gave you the freedom to discover that on your own, which I think is a brilliant move on his part, but also probably quite risky.
That's very much Alexander's approach, though. He does like to surround himself with people he trusts, and challenge them to do their best work. And that is
so. Rolf, does he send you a script? Does he pick up the phone and say, "Hey, I've got this film, and let me tell you a little bit about it," and or do you see the film and you sit down and you got fresh eyes and it's now you go for your walk and you start, you know, or you have a shower and you start humming some of those.
It's the latter. It's the latter, yeah. Definitely. The I often get sent the screenplays, but they don't really present you with the challenge. They don't present you with the canvas. So
interesting. Yeah.
There's nothing to paint on. I mean, it's
right.
And canvas is probably a bad example. Maybe it's almost like putting trompe l'oeil in a you know what trompe l'oeil is, when you do this sort of fake architecture painted onto a wall of a building to make it seem like the building keeps on going behind the wall.
Yes, yeah, it's hilarious. We were in Quebec City this summer. That's so funny. I was looking at some pictures with my son just a couple of days ago, and there's a shot with that image in the background on a building, and it looks like he's standing in, you know, in this sort of 3D-like setting. It's really quite
exactly
peculiar.
So so you can't start thinking up what the trompe l'oeil is going to look like until you know what the building looks like.
Right, right.
And that is absolutely the case with
so the image, the dialogue, the characters, that is your canvas, that is the structure.
Well, yeah, because because timing is key, especially where if you want there to be humor or thrills, you have to get the timing absolutely spot on. And sometimes the film has problems or has long, boring sequences, and you want to find a way of making that more interesting and more engaging or more edgy. And to be honest, that is sometimes in the screenplay, but there's no way of doing it until the music comes in. If you want a protracted sequence, a long sequence of someone sort of coming into a house and creeping around and the creaks of the floorboards, and you want to build that sense of tension, and sometimes that is simply never going to be there until the music provides it. So it might be in the screenplay that this is a tense sequence building and building and building, but it's not going to look like much unless the music's there. So a lot of those, all those sort of internal things. And quite often you get asked to sort of solve problems. You know, there should be chemistry between these two people. Why is there not chemistry? And you figure out how to create chemistry with music. And suddenly there it is. But you wouldn't know that there wasn't chemistry from the screenplay because no one's acted it yet.
So good. I love it. I can't wait to ask you a question about some of your favorite musical moments. But I want to talk a little bit about this film. I saw it at the Toronto International Film Festival with Elizabeth, my wife, and I'm sorry we didn't get to cross paths there. We couldn't make it work out. But I remember coming out of Downsizing and really loving it and finding it to be absurd and funny and peculiar, and it's an environmental film and it's all these things. And I remember walking back to the car and saying to the film, you know what, it's a disaster film. And it struck me, you know, that it's got this dystopic kind of edge. It's the end of the world. If we're so screwed if we don't get this stuff sorted out. It was like this, and I wonder to what degree, you know, it's just so, and this is one of the reasons I just so love and I'm so passionate about film, because the way that the story is told, it's just working on so many levels, and your music played a part in me having that moment, that shock of recognition. And I think it's really quite remarkable the collaborative process and you tell me about the way you compose the music for the film, but I mean, there's comedic moments, there's absurd moments, there's, you know, the serious moments, and it's really, really quite remarkable.
Well, good, thank you. It's quite a Picard-esque film, by which I mean it happens in sort of in chapters more than a piece.
Yes.
And the music sometimes occurs in that way as well. I mean, there are definitely melodic themes that sort of are threaded all the way through. But there are also, you know, elements which really only occur in single chapters. So, you know, the whole downsizing procedure is a big musical occasion with, I think it's about 8.5 minutes of through scored film, which may not sound much to you, but in terms of scoring a film, is actually quite a long sequence, and with a very strong theme, which I don't think ever recurs in the film, because it's really all about that one moment.
Right.
But I'm running out of my thread.
No, it's okay. I mean, I don't know what the thread really is myself, but I think I'm really struck by I am struck by the thread, you know. And I made notes on the film, and one of the thoughts I had scribbled down, you know, in the darkness of the theater, was that the music felt to me like, in certain points anyway, chapter headings, as if you were taking us into different, you know, parts of what's his name, Sophronic, of his life, of Matt Damon's character's life. I mean, it really is an existential crisis this guy's going through, and that's where I think I really saw some of that dystopic edge. Do you think it's a science fiction film?
Well, no. I mean, like, of course, the technology it talks about does not exist. So to that degree, right, it's science fiction. But I think when people, I think it's not particularly helpful to call it a science fiction film, because it creates all sorts of expectations which are not satisfied by I think when we say science fiction, we mean something else. And but I do find that, and I think this is a thread in all Alexander's films, is they're very much about humanity and different perspectives on humanity. And sometimes, you know, looking at humanity from way above, just going, what a concept, you know, what are they up to? And to a degree, this film does that. But I think the way it impacted the music, or the way the music sort of was drawn into the equation, was that there are all these huge things going on. There's global climate change. And then within the conceit of the film, there is this technological process by which people are shrunk to being 5 inches tall. So there are these sort of massive sort of external things happening. And within all of this, we have humanity. And we're both make sense of it. And we're also trying to identify with the characters who are trying to make sense of it. And in the heart of this film, we have this lovely Midwestern character who's smart but a bit of a dope in other ways. And so we have this dopey theme, this sort of cheerful,
right,
buoyant, which is a very whistleable little tune. It's pretty much the first thing I wrote, and it immediately stuck to picture. And we see it at the very beginning of the film when we see Matt Damon as Paul Safronik, or Safronik. They always pronounce it. Yeah, it's supposed to be Safronik.
Everyone pronounces his name wrong, which for me was just A, hysterical, and B, isn't that kind of, that's the existential crisis, yeah, right?
Yeah.
I think, and I think that from my take on Alexander Payne's films, and Sideways is one of my faves of all time.
Right.
There is that, you know, who am I and where am I going and how am I going to get there? And what I love is that it's always in and through relationship that we get there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And by the end, you know, he's turned that corner and he's actually become more. He's become purposeful, authoritative.
Yes.
If only for a moment. I mean, it's very brief, but you see it. You see it at the end, and so his tune comes back, but it may not be recognizable anymore because it's now, instead of being played on a whistle, it's being played by a symphony orchestra. But it was very much one of those sort of, to my mind, it was one of those Ennio Morricone kind of opportunities to be sort of big and melodic at the very end. And to be honest, I wrote a much bigger version, you know, I got asked to scale it down.
That's funny.
I went very big. I went, this is the beautiful, this is the cinematic, you know, the
right
thing. And again, yeah, you're too big. You've gone too big, Rolf. Turn it, bring it back. So I used to have all the brass and all the woodwind and everybody. And really, I ended up just with, I think, flute and strings. But it still has that majesty and that... that sort of mature authority that it absolutely doesn't have at the beginning.
I travel a fair bit to Cambodia, to Southeast Asia, and I've seen some really interesting and peculiar instruments, or at least what I would call peculiar. Cambodians wouldn't, of course. That can create some very interesting sounds to the Western ear, to the English, to the you know, the guy who's got roots in Luton, to his ear. What are some of your faves? Some of the instruments that you compose with, and I think the other question I'm fascinated or interested to hear about is: do you sit down at the keyboard first? Or do you go to a stringed instrument? Is it a guitar? Is it a piccolo? Where do you go first?
Oh, well, firstly, I've just picked up this instrument. I have no idea. I think it's Indonesian. It's got three strings.
Hang on a minute. You're the musician. What are you talking about? That's so...
I have no idea what it's called. I call it Twucky.
Twucky.
Yeah, and... It features on quite a few scores, actually. I really like
it.
And I believe it's Indonesian. My brother brought it to me when he was traveling around the world, one of those once-in-a-lifetime
trips. Yes.
And so that's... you might look at it and know what it is. I look at it and I know it's Twucky. That's all.
Is it kind of coconut-shaped, like, on one end? Maybe like a leather or an animal skin, and then you got your three strings up along, sort of wooden, almost like a guitar, sort of.
Yes, it's much smaller, much smaller than a coconut.
Okay.
And it may be a snake skin cover.
Could be snake skin. Yeah, I bet. I certainly sounds like I've seen and heard those types of instruments before, but it's very distinctive, very unique, right?
Yeah, absolutely. As regards process, if I'm not walking and humming, then I move around. I definitely start at the keyboard, and then when I'm frustrated and realize that everything I'm doing is rubbish, then I will switch to guitar or voice or violin or occasionally wind instruments. For melody, the melodica is phenomenal. And It's a great idea to move between instruments because they just do different things. So one's very unlikely to do lots of repeated notes on a piano because it's boring.
Right.
But lots of repeated notes on a voice is perfectly fine. You can, you know, you're not going to go ding, 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 but you might go mi, a, pi, la, so, and then change. And it makes much more sense. You go mi, la, pi, la, so, ho, ho. Whereas ding, 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 doesn't sound like it was very clever writing. So the instrument you screw around on changes the kind of writing one's likely to do.
And we kind of come full circle almost, and we're talking, I mean, you tell me you're the musician, but we're talking about tone again, right? And I mean, we're talking about tone of the film and the image and the lighting and the cinematography. Again, I marvel at the collaborative nature of connecting all those dots. And isn't, you know, and maybe this is a little bit of a stretch, but isn't that what we're all trying to do existentially as well, right? As we, you know, I've studied philosophy for years, and Kierkegaard talks about, as my listener will know, I've quoted this before, but, you know, you step into the future, that's the only way you can live. And then the only way you understand is when you start to look back and you see the thread, right? And I would imagine, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I would imagine you finish a film and watch a film and go, wow, I didn't quite see that connection before, but it, you know, it kind of makes...
Perspective is everything, isn't it? And it's perspective is very elusive. And I think, you know, sometimes I think one wants to keep perspective as best one can all the time. But actually, I don't think that is true. I think it's at least not to get this kind of work done. It's good to sort of just bury oneself in it and then step back. I don't know if it's actually possible to be as committed and wholehearted in the work if one maintains perspective all the time. It is a balance of losing yourself to it and then pulling out and looking at it. I mean, there's a thing. I'm really bad at this and trying to get better, which is simply watching the whole film with the music that I've cut, that I've done so far, because I would rather be writing than watching a playback, because it always seems like time is wasting if I'm simply watching, not writing. But the fact is that when you watch, you see it in perspective, and then you just go, "Oh God, what was that piece of music? It felt great when I was writing the piece of music itself." But when you see right. context, it doesn't belong there at all. It's the
right.
It's far too busy or noisy or something. So, but you can't really commit to a. I tend to, you know, I get very involved in the emotions of the music I'm writing, and I like that. I think it's a good thing to really believe in that moment. And so, you know, in composing, sometimes. You know, I haven't written the music for this scene, but I will watch it and connect with the emotion and then really feel the emotion, like sort of pull it up and let it well up. And then I will compose the music that goes with what I've just felt. And that's a complete loss of overall perspective and a commitment to that moment. But I think it's one of the most effective ways of writing emotionally connecting music.
Rolf, I could talk to you all evening, man. This is fantastic. I've so enjoyed our conversation. Gonna have to wrap it up here in a couple of minutes, I think, sadly. But I mean, for me, downsizing is like any pretty much any film I watch, documentary. Narrative. It's about so much more than what you're seeing on screen. There's so much more going on than meets the eye. And there's a little piece at the end, and it's when he's walking, I think, down the tunnel, and he's going through that decision process. Sophronic's character, Matt Damon's character, and wondering where he's going to go. And the music's marvelous, by the way, like just remarkable. And there's something about memory there, and I think, and I can't remember her name right now off the top of my head. That's horrible. But the woman he's falling in love with, and
crying.
Thank you. And he says, or she says something to the effect of, "Once he's come, words not matter. Remember me before he walks in." And for me, that's the power of music, right? I mean, it's like the power of a smell it pulls you back into something in a way that, you know, I guess to Steven Soderbergh's point about, you know, scoring Raiders of the Lost Ark with a, you know, just changes everything.
Well, that was,
changes it, right?
Yeah, well, actually, that's a very interesting moment, because people were a little unclear as to why he makes the decision he makes. And I said, well, why don't we let them know by echoing her theme so strongly that you get the sense that, you know, it's her that is making him make that decision. And so it was a way of definitively assisting the narrative and the way the narrative lands. Yeah.
So great. I'm honestly, Rolf, I'm getting goosebumps. No kidding. It's fantastic. Rolf, what a pleasure chatting with you. Can you talk about what your next project is just before we wrap?
Well, right now, yes, I'm writing writing music for and producing a piece of immersive theatre.
Wow.
Yeah, which is an intriguing challenge and should be great fun. I love theatre and the recent sort of blossoming of immersive in London and New York and now in Los Angeles just seemed like there should be music in this you know field, and so
what a world it would be without it.
Well, oh, geez. Yeah, exactly.
Can we you've got a website, rolfkent.com?
Yep.
People can find out more about you, they can listen, you've got some samples there about your bio film, they can contact you, and I'm sure we're going to hear more about your immersive piece of theater there. We've been talking to Rolf Kent today about music, composition, existentialism, and I would think becoming better humans as well. Rolf, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Really
appreciate it.
Lovely talking to you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.